Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 118, featuring Kurt Akeley from Lytro. He's actually the CTO of Lytro. And for those of you guys who don't know what Lytro is, it's kind of a big deal. But a little bit of history about Kurt. Lon, you're joining me for the podcast. So Kurt was one of the founders of SGI way back in the day. And he also did things like sort of bring to light OpenGL.
Yeah, he knows just a little bit about computer graphics, I would say.
Yeah. He built the second ever laser printer. And he's done a bunch of things. He's really interested in electrical engineering and computer graphics. So he kind of builds things and makes things that work with computer graphics. So his big thing now that he's been studying a lot is light fields. And there's a lot of misinformation about light fields. And I think that would help us to sort of understand what it is. And honestly, before I started recording the podcast, I had a lot of misinformation about light field. So you are going to witness me struggling to understand light fields as I'm actually going through the podcast. And it wasn't until after I'd done recording and I digested what Kurt had told me that I realized what it is. But I'm going to give you a head start for the audience members, and Lon, you can listen too. But the whole point of light fields is that it is the correct information of light within a volume, all from all directions, all kinds of stuff. And what you do with that, there's a lot of things you can do with it.
You can do anything.
You can do anything with it, right?
That's the point.
That's the point. You can make a camera within there that can just take a picture inside the light field. You can make a VR experience. You can just do a whole lot of things. And there's one thing that he says over and over again in the podcast, which I still use now as the correct thing. It's like, once the light field is correct, if you know the light field is correct, then you're done. You don't have any, then there's nothing else to do, right? Light field is the correct information of lighting inside of a volume. And it's really kind of interesting how you derive that and what it's about. So Lytro has been focusing a lot on this. They make cameras that can see light fields. They've started off with, they called it the Butterstick camera. Remember that thing?
I know, it's such a great nickname.
I think that was their nickname for it, but it basically looked like a Butterstick, and yeah, it would take pictures and you could change the focus on it. Which is just one trick that you can do in light fields.
Which is awesome, by the
right.
way. That's,
yeah.
I wish I could do that with all my...
all your photographs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, they built a big cinema camera. They also built a VR thing that they're working on, which obviously there's a lot of information that they're looking at that we're looking at. So we've been chatting with them for a while. And they're really, really nice guys. Kurt is brilliant, super nice guy. Really love hanging out with him and knowing this information. Remember, I do sound a little bit like an idiot when I'm trying to listen to this podcast or when I'm talking to him, because it's just not sinking into my head exactly what you can do with light field. Not what you can do, what light field actually is, because that's what he's interested in, not what you can do with it. What you can do with it is great. There's lots of use cases, but let's start with the idea of a proper light field. Okay, so enough about that. Little announcements. Let's see. You're going to be talking somewhere, aren't you?
Yeah, I'll be heading back to my hometown, Chicago.
Nice.
For Built World Summit.
Built World Summit.
And I'll be talking in a AR-VR panel, so I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome.
Also, go Cubs. we will be down at AIA in Orlando.
Uh-huh.
That's coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, I think we have a booth there and stuff. Melissa will be there.
Yeah.
Corey will be there. A bunch of people will be there.
Mm-hmm. And then we'll be at FMX as well. That's coming up real soon. So you'll be there. Vlado will be there.
I'll be at FMX. Vlado will be at FMX. He's speaking there. I'm on a board, so I'll be moderating some talks over there. We're going to do a live podcast over there while we're doing it. Well, live recording of the podcast, so we'll do it in front of an audience. That will be fun. There's a bunch of...
some good presentations, some GPU rendering presentations with Thomas from Debarty. And
some guys from Unit Image.
And the Unit Image, man, I love their stuff. It's so good.
Unit Image, really cool stuff. And then some guys from Macavision and Scanline.
Yep.
So check out V-Ray Days and just go to our website, chaosgroup.com, go to events. I'm sure you'll find information about it.
Yep.
Max on there.
Top one.
All right. And I think that's about it. So with that, hopefully you guys will enjoy this great podcast with Kurt Akeley. All right. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
The reason I was excited to meet with you is because light field is something that I think is there's a lot of misnomer about it.
Okay.
And I've heard a lot of people describe it in different ways and talk about it in both positive and negative ways.
Uh-huh.
And the best description I heard was you at the keynote of the Vision Summit conference. I think it was last year. You gave mm-hmm. like about a 5-minute
yeah.
description of light field. There was like, that's it. That's the one I want to hear. That's the one I want to people to understand and explain. But so that's why I'm excited to see you. But I wanted to give people a little bit of a context
sure.
as to your background and where this came from and where that understanding of light field came from. So what is uh-huh. what is some of your background? How did this all the way come to where we are now?
Well, in broad strokes, I've been doing computer graphics for a long time. I was an undergraduate in 76 to 80.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I built one of the world's first laser printers, a full system.
Wow.
The department actually used it for a few years. So I was in the, I like building things.
That, okay.
That's a theme for my sort of private life and professional career. And then I got to Stanford in a PhD program looking around for some professor to build something with. And I happened into Jim Clark, who was on the verge of turning his geometry engine idea into a prototype and then a product.
Uh-huh.
And so I worked with him. We co-founded Silicon Graphics. I did that for 20 years. And during that time, I led the development of all of SGI's high-end computer graphics systems.
Right.
And the development of OpenGL, which is normally thought of as an API for graphics, but I think it's more powerfully understood to be the architecture.
Yes.
Of interactive computer graphics systems, the agreement point between software that uses systems and hardware that implements systems.
I remember because I was at Rice University during my grad school, and I had come from a math background in my architecture school.
Mm-hmm.
I had an undergraduate in mathematics, and I was using Next Machines at that point, using Mathematica, and I loved using those. And that's when I started getting into graphics. Then I moved to Rice University in the architecture field, and they just built a brand new lab, and they called it RAVL, which is the Rice Architecture Visualization Lab, and they just bought these SGIs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And these SGIs had something very, very special, which was called OpenGL and a different kind of frame buffer that was involved. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of what you had developed, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So that frame buffer was very, very different. Can you explain how what that frame buffer became and how it just suddenly just became something that we all know as OpenGL?
Yeah, well, I probably wouldn't call it the frame buffer, but you know, right. that graphics architecture
right.
was one that was designed along the lines that Jim Clark had envisioned for quite a while, which
right.
is the maxim is, you know, if it doesn't move, it's not 3D.
Right.
And, or the way I put that, if you don't like the way the picture looks, do it again. Right.
Right.
So it's 2D graphics in my mind is the graphics of modifying images.
Mm-hmm.
3D graphics is the graphics of recreating images. And the power of it is you've got enough horsepower and enough connectivity between this graphics and wherever the source of the data is, you know, a modern game engine or, you know, whatever it is,
sure.
to be able to redraw the image really quick.
Right.
So in VR, you know, now we're doing 90 to 120 frames per second binocular,
uh-huh. right.
which was, you know, and GPUs have gotten faster by something like a factor of 10 million during my the
right.
career that I have been
yes.
designing them and implementing them. So I'm flabbergasted every day
yeah.
at what's possible. But it's still the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just keep recreating from fundamental principles
mm-hmm.
imagery at whatever rate is required to serve the viewing audience. And for virtual reality, it's quite a bit higher than what we used to think of as interactive frame rates. Even
right.
Even for visual simulation, it's higher for VR.
I think it's what's interesting is that it was so fast at a point that it didn't start to not matter so much. And now suddenly with VR, the demands are so much greater that it's
exactly.
starting to matter again.
Yeah, I did a talk at the keynote at VR 2004. And one uh-huh. of the things I did was just plotted out for a bunch of different capabilities that were going to matter for virtual reality, mm-hmm. what factor of performance we were going to need an increase, mm-hmm. you know, and that boiled down to something like 10,000. And then you can back out of that the log exponential rate of increase.
Right.
And what it predicted is somewhere right around now, we'd be there.
Right.
And sure enough, here we are.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, I was just actually testing a brand new GPU. It's not quite released yet, but it's already twice as fast as it was 18 months ago. So that's almost like that Moore's Law is starting to come back into play in this sense.
It hasn't gone away.
It hasn't gone away.
Right.
I know.
It hasn't gone away.
A lot of people say it's gone away, but it hasn't in a sense. Yeah.
I mean, people and NVIDIA wanted to believe that they were at a 2x per year rate.
Right.
And they never really were. Mm-hmm. But you know, somewhere around 1.3 or 1.4 has been sustained for decades
right.
now. And that compound growth rate figured out over those 35 years I've been doing this is that's where you get these big numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, logarithmic scale is kind of nice. So you're at SGI and you're one of the founders of SGI and you were interested in the computer graphic world at that point. And so how did that go?
Yeah, so what happened? So when I left SGI kind of 2000, 2001, depending, went back to Stanford mm-hmm. to work with my friend Pat Hanrahan to write a book about interactive computer graphics systems. Mm-hmm. We never actually wrote the book. Mm-hmm. We taught courses that were the contents of what the book would have been, mm-hmm. but I found I liked being back at Stanford a lot, so I thought maybe I could finish my PhD, and Pat allowed us that maybe that was possible. And indeed, that's what I did.
Okay.
And that kind of got me off into this closer to light field work. In fact, my dissertation is about a light field display, okay. although just like the term architecture isn't in the OpenGL specification, the term light field isn't in my dissertation.
Okay.
But what it was a display that addressed this vergence accommodation conflict. Mm-hmm. So it allowed people to focus on the thing they were fixating on.
Right.
And that solves fundamental problems in virtual reality and especially augmented reality display systems and amounts to a light field thing. And then from there, I ended up moving to Lytro. Mm-hmm. And then it's pretty obvious how that involves developing my understanding of light fields. So that's what I've done.
Yeah, so keep in mind a lot of my audience, some of them are very technical and are going to understand a lot of what you're talking about, and some of them are not. And so one of the things I want to make sure we understand is like light field is something that is going to become very, or is already becoming very, very known in our lexicon at this point. Mm-hmm. We're going to start to talk about it more and more, and it's going to become, I feel it's going to become a point where it's going to, you know, people mention it on CNN and everyone will know what they're talking about, right? But but right now we're not quite there yet.
No.
And I think that there is something that's important to understand. And I think one of the things I really liked about what you were explaining in light field is the different scales at which light fields can be experienced, down from like the light field within a pupil, light mm-hmm. field between two eyes, and light field within a room, or all of those things. So what is it exactly that is a light field, and how is it different than a typical photograph?
Sure. Okay. So a light field mm-hmm. is the description of how light is moving through a volume or across a surface. Mm-hmm. The reason you can simplify it to across a surface instead of through a volume mm-hmm. is by and large, we can understand light to travel in straight lines.
Okay.
In the limit, when you squeeze down to very small apertures and very small scales, then that breaks up. Quantum mm-hmm. mechanics messes with it.
Right.
But at most scales, most of the time, we can think of light as traveling in straight lines. And therefore, if you know what's going on across the surface, you can infer very powerfully what's happening in the volume that surrounds that surface.
Okay.
So when people talk about a light field, often they're talking about just information at a surface. But we all know that that gives you a huge amount of understanding about what's really happening in a volume.
Okay. So across the surface, so let's start with the pupil as
sure.
an example, right? Because I think that was the best way to start. So on the pupil, we don't exactly have a pinhole camera, right?
Exactly, not at all, right?
So because that is like a CG rendering in a traditional sense, mm-hmm. it's almost like a pinhole camera, right?
A simplistic one. Of course, modern realistic ones like V-Ray certainly wouldn't make that mistake.
But it is basically the idea of a pinhole camera where everything is sharp and everything is in focus from one single point of mm-hmm. space. And so an iris has a diameter and therefore lets in light from different areas, right?
Yeah, across an area,
right.
from a volume, but across an area.
Okay.
And so if we wanted to know everything, essentially everything about the light that was reaching the retina, mm-hmm. we could predict that very reliably if we knew exactly what the light was doing across a surface at the pupil.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's sort of a fictitious mathematical surface. Choose some surface.
Right.
And then just if we knew for every point on that surface how much light at which different frequencies was passing in each direction,
mm-hmm.
then we would be able to easily extrapolate that to how much light at which frequencies was hitting each receptor in the retina.
Right.
Right. And we can, and you're, you know, ray tracing or any lots of technologies allow us to do that.
Right.
So the all we need to know is that information about that essentially four-dimensional function,
right.
a two-dimensional array of points and then two-dimensional information at each one, sort of describing the different directions through those points.
Okay.
That's the light field.
Sure. So on a ray trace, let's just use the ray trace as an example. What we do is we take that example, but then we bake it down to a single image where the
yes.
focus is set at a specific place. But what a light, what like, let's take the first camera that became public that everyone started to know, the little camera. What
yeah.
was it called?
We often call it the butter stick inside. I think it was just called the Litro light field camera.
Right. But it looks like a little butter stick. And it had a chip in the back that it was an area that, but what was unique about it is that it captured everything, but it almost interrupted the process before you focused, right?
Well, yes, it captured the light field
right.
in the plane of the sensor.
Right.
So a standard image is not capturing the light field. This light field at a surface is a four-dimensional spatial function.
Right.
Right. Two dimensions of space, two dimensions of angle.
Okay.
An image reduces that to just two dimensions of space.
Right.
Okay. So we've lost, if you think of it inside the camera, you've lost all the angular information. It no longer matters for any given pixel in the image
right.
which direction the light came from. It's just integrated all that together.
Right.
And it's got an answer, which is how much light hit that point. So that is a reduction of the four-dimensional light field to just a two-dimensional image.
Exactly.
If you have the four-dimensional light field, if you actually capture and save it, mm-hmm. then at any later date, you can do any reduction you want of that four-dimensional data to an image.
Right.
So you can adjust the focus distance, you can adjust the center of perspective, you can adjust anything you want within the constraints of how much data you've got.
Right.
And that's a pretty powerful
it's a very powerful thing. Yeah. So that idea of being able to change focus and change aperture is that's the beginning of where I guess I was like, oh, okay. It seemed like, oh, that's a cool camera, you can change the focus or whatever, but this is the beginning, right? And then you guys scaled that up to the point where I think was it last year did you guys introduce the cinema? The big camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big version of those little cameras.
Right. So that sensor is how big? Is it half a meter across?
I don't. Have we talked about the size of it?
Yeah. I think it was.
It's big.
It's a very big sensor.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of pixels. I think we talk about that. It's
yeah.
Call it a billion. I mean, among friends, it's 750 million or something. But
right.
just in rough numbers, it's a lot.
It's a lot. And so, what? So the first thing that sort of like struck a chord with me is the enormous amount of data.
Yes.
Okay, because what you're doing is you're capturing every possibility almost that you would imagine of an image all captured into this light field.
Yeah, that's a way to think of it,
right?
That's sort of a constructionist way to think of it.
Right, because yeah. I'm good. I can all of this data now I can rebuild the image in any way that I see fit. In a lot of ways, I could because the aperture is so big. I can change parallax within a certain range.
That's right. That's right.
I can change the distance that I want, and I can change the focus. And what other things are possible?
I'd say there's a handful of things. One way to think of it is that if you capture the light field,
mm-hmm.
then the process of changing a light field into an image
mm-hmm.
is the process of simulating a camera in that light field.
Right.
Right. So that simulated camera can do anything that a regular camera can do.
Okay.
What can you do with a camera? You can focus it. You can point it in different places. You can move it.
Mm-hmm.
Just picture anything you can do with a regular camera,
right.
you can do with that virtual camera. Actually, you can do more
okay.
with the virtual camera. So, for example, you can create focus blur that doesn't fall off in the sort of quasi-linear way that focus blur falls off in a real camera. We can make it non-linear or discontinuous or whatever we want.
Right.
So there's opportunities to do more, but it's mind expanding enough to just consider the possibility that you can do everything a regular camera can do.
Right.
Right. So that's the way I like to think about it. It isn't some hocus pocus mathematical, here's how we take the light field and turn it into an image. Mm-hmm. Just think of the light field as that information, everything about light,
right,
passing through some surface, put a virtual camera with its lens right at that surface, mm-hmm. and then do whatever you want with the virtual camera.
Yes. I know it was a little bit hard to wrap my mind around it. But as I started to think about it, you know, a lot of people were describing use cases. I think mm-hmm. that's the best way for people to sort of digest this information. And so you can recreate any camera that you want in a virtual world.
You can simulate any physical camera.
So you can take you can take some of the old, was it the Zeiss lenses that were used on the Kubrick films that mm-hmm. were like, they only made three of them, I think, and two of them are on the moon.
relatively out of reach, although SpaceX is working on it, right?
but so that you could recreate those lenses at, but not just in the CG world, you're actually creating them from actual physical things that the light field can capture. That's the thing that I think is interesting about it. The light field is actually capturing real light scenarios in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that I think is a really fascinating idea that all of these looks can be achieved through this thing. So where do you guys, where has this camera gone?
The cinematic one?
The cinematic.
I won't go into a lot of details about it, but the net is it's doing a pretty complicated thing to capture that many pixels.
Right.
And there are engineering challenges to making the result of that essentially flawless.
Right. And it's a little bit large at this point too, right?
Yeah, that's right. but I think in some sense, it needs to be large. Mm-hmm. Remember I said that light behaves like it goes in straight lines unless you squeeze it down too much. Mm-hmm. Well, if you try to make the camera too small, you'll squeeze it down too much. And then some of the fundamental assumptions that light fields make start not working out.
Right.
So size is actually the friend of capturing light fields. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons that virtual reality works so well with it.
Okay.
Because we're actually interested in capturing a light field in a large volume.
Right.
Right.
So you guys, okay, well, let's talk about that because you guys, there's been a lot of images out there of your virtual reality captured mm-hmm. light field camera. Mm-hmm. So let's explain that. Let's expand that because that's a different kind of light field, I'm assuming.
Well, no.
That's
right. I'll say is there's any number of ways to sort of infer a light field from a bunch of data, mm-hmm. but there are two primary ways to directly capture a light field.
Okay.
One of those ways is to have the light enter a single objective lens, kind of like a regular, think of a Nikon or a Canon camera or something. Mm-hmm. Light comes in that one lens. It gets roughly focused onto a sensor, mm-hmm. and then it's possible to augment that sensor. So instead of just capturing the 2D image, it actually captures the 4D light field at that point.
Right.
This is one way to do it.
Okay.
The other way to do it is to just take a bunch of cameras, mm-hmm. each with a regular lens, mm-hmm. arrange them in some spatial pattern, mm-hmm. a large plane or a sphere, you know, in some sense it doesn't matter mm-hmm. conceptually, but for the comparison I'll make, let's put them in a plane.
Okay.
And then capture images on these separate cameras at different places.
So it could be just an array of cameras.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It'll be an array, and then maybe it's a, you know, a regular rectangular grid of cameras, or maybe it's a hex pattern.
Right.
These are details.
Okay.
My point here is that mathematically, those two ways that look physically very different, mm-hmm. mathematically, they're the same.
Okay.
Right. The information that you capture is the same information. It's just organized in really different ways.
Okay.
That's the mathematical approach. Now, if you dig down a level and you say, well, you know, are they really identical? Well, they're not quite identical. There'll be slight differences in aliasing qualities and yada. But there's one fundamental, practical, huge difference between them. Mm-hmm. And that is if you wanted to capture the light field across a large surface, I'm holding my hands up showing a circle like a foot or two in diameter.
Right.
It's pretty hard to make a single objective lens that's that big. And even if it's not hard, it's expensive and heavy. And there's a lot of challenges to that.
Sure.
So if you want to capture a light field across a kind of a human scale, some number of feet surface, really the only practical way to do it is to have a bunch of separate cameras.
Okay.
Versus if you want to capture a light field like our early consumer products did, that's on the order of an inch or two in it's a planar light field, then capturing it with a single objective lens and using this planoptic mechanism at the sensor has a lot of advantages. So if you just, to simplify it down, if you're trying to capture a big light field, you want to use lots of cameras. If you're trying to capture a little one, the planoptic stuff works.
So explain planoptic so that some people understand that.
Well, it's just a fancy word that has to do with putting a bunch of micro lenses in front of a sensor.
Gotcha.
So we're going to, you know, we're going to
make it. It's basically teeny little cameras.
That's right.
Teeny little cameras.
That's exactly right. And each camera has sort of tens to hundreds of pixels in it.
Yeah.
And it's a vanishingly small camera. You literally can't see it with the human eye.
Okay. But so, as you said, it's essentially the same thing.
It accomplishes the same goal mathematically, but there are various practical concerns that give one strong motivation to go one way or the other, depending on the problem to be solved.
Okay. All right. So we have seen in the VR world, several companies have created systems that do this in the spherical world, because obviously now the spherical cameras in 360 degrees has become an important part of the capturing process that's part in the VR world.
Yep.
Most of the 360 content we're seeing out there are just monoscopic videos that are good, but it's basically just a big dome. Now, you expand, instead of having, it's the same problem, right? Instead of going from a single point that captures the whole dome, we're now expanding this dome to a sphere and creating a spherical camera system that goes around. So there's a company like Jaunt, and I think Google has, what's it called, Jump, I believe?
And Facebook 360.
Okay, and those are all just a lot of cameras in a circle or in a
sphere. They're organized in some pattern. Typically not sort of symmetrically spherical, because maybe you care more about things closer to the horizon than you care about things. So these are sort of engineering choices.
Sure.
Where do I put my resources?
Okay.
But yes, they're the attempt is to capture a light field in some small volume.
Right. And most of the only goals that they seem to really have, the goals they seem to have is to have it just to achieve stereoscopic images in some way. Right?
That's right. And even they're often compromised again as an engineering choice, so that the stereo works when you look in some directions with some head orientations, and it works less well when you look in other directions with different.
Okay.
You know. So they've traded off again, typically for the horizon.
Right.
Yeah. So let's make the horizon work best.
Yep. Yeah. Honestly, we do the same thing. We have a 300, like in a virtual one in V-Ray, right? Which is a virtual 360-degree dome with stereo, where we do a stereo image that works in any direction as you expand it, but our problems are the poles.
Exactly. So when you move away from the horizon, the thing works less and less well.
Right. So we just basically de-stereofy as we get to the poles.
Yeah.
Now, what is your camera like, and how is this camera different?
Well, the camera is different in one sense, because we're capturing, I think, quite a few more images than the typical ones that are out there.
How many more? Like, can you say it?
100-ish rather than 10-ish.
Okay,
I think is fair. You know, without getting into fine details, and our goal is not just to get stereo to kind of work, but it's to get all of the geometric parallax cues to work completely and work correctly for all orientations and all positions of a viewer within a volume of enough size to be interesting.
Okay.
Probably less than a room, but a lot more than what you and I are moving around in as we carried this conversation. Our heads are actually almost stable.
Sure.
Right. I'm moving around a couple
of feet,
Yeah. So on the order of feet. But not tens of feet.
Okay.
So all orientations of the viewer, all positions of the viewer in that volume, all parallax cues are correct.
Okay. Now, this is an important thing that I want people to realize, is that this is not just geometry and color. this is everything that is view dependent is correct.
Or at least our goal is to make it as correct as possible. These, you know, these are not perfect systems.
Right.
But, yes.
But more specifically, because my architects will understand
this. Very good.
Things that are view dependent, such as reflections and refractions, will change through parallax.
That's correct.
So as you move your head back and forth, I can see the reflections of the mm-hmm. lights in this whiteboard here. If I move my head back and forth, those reflections will move across that whiteboard.
That's right.
A light field will capture that difference.
Yes. And if you have sufficient resolution in your light field and sufficient calculation in all of your playback, mm-hmm. then it gets it all exactly right.
Okay.
Right. No physical system has sufficient resolution to get it exactly right.
Okay.
So where we are with our playback is we get the straightforward parallax cues, the cues that are to do with the positions of objects in the scene, mm-hmm. vanishingly close to exactly right.
Right.
Those view-dependent shading things, we're doing pretty well on.
Right.
But I wouldn't say, yeah, we're getting them exactly right.
And no, that, but
that's
it's
an area of huge concentration for us.
Yeah,
and they're remarkably good. So I mean, if you've looked in these,
I have looked at some of the systems, and I am very. The best way I can say it is that it's the best I've ever seen.
Exactly,
and that makes a big difference because you're right. It's not perfect yet, because I don't think the VR world is perfect.
No.
By far. There's a lot of interesting solutions out there, but it is the best I've seen.
Yep.
And I don't think that I don't think that people can necessarily wrap their heads around it. There's a lot of ways, and you're like, okay, so I sacrifice reflections or I sacrifice refraction or whatever. And for some video games, for example, that may be fine.
Yeah.
But for an architect, reflections and refractions are critical.
That's their game, right?
They're critical.
Or
right?
if you build and sell automobiles, or if you
know, yes.
there's a bunch of places where there's deep, deep care
right.
about modeling light very accurately.
Okay.
And
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those things are very, very important. I think they're critical to understanding why light field is important in a lot of ways, and mm-hmm. why it brings it up to this level that's above anything else. So with that being said, what are some of the current limitations that you feel are there that you feel like you want to overcome in the next you mentioned it. There's a few things you want to overcome.
Yeah, yeah. I say so. In the realm of parallax, I'll start.
Okay.
That human beings experience geometric parallax in three different ways.
Okay.
With what I would call the head motion parallax. The mm. world looks different. I'm moving my head left to right.
Right.
I see things behind your head here that I don't see when I'm here.
Right.
Right? That's the head motion parallax.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the binocular parallax. The world looks different through my left eye than my right eye.
Yes.
Right. We're getting both of those essentially perfectly correct.
Okay.
Right. The third kind of parallax is focus parallax, where this conversation started out.
Yes.
This is where you've got to have a light field capture that's accurate enough to make useful distinctions across someone's pupil. And that's a lot more accurate light field than you would need to make useful distinctions for binocular by about a factor of, you know, an order of magnitude or two, depending on how you... the size of the pupil.
So, right.
So it's
how is
this is hard, and we haven't fully done that.
No.
Yet.
So okay. So the current VR headsets that are looking at right now are basically just a lens that's looking at a screen, right? There is no depth to that image.
Well, there's
per eye.
No. There's no. The focus cues, the one that drives your accommodation, that's the fancy word for changing the focus of mm-hmm. your eye,
mm-hmm.
and then the cues that determine how blurry the things are that you're not fixating on,
right.
retinal blur cues,
mm-hmm.
neither of those is driven correctly by current VR displays.
Right.
In fact, you can make the retinal blur cues a lot better mm-hmm. without changing the display.
Okay.
Right? But you can't make the accommodation stimulus better without changing the display. So the display is a fundamental constraint. Hence my PhD dissertation
right.
of 10 to 15 years ago, whatever. Yeah, I guess
that
was it explored a technology to make the display able to do its part in addressing the stimulation of accommodation.
Sure.
So there's hardware optical work that has to happen, and then there's a lot more work in the image generation that has to happen. When both of those things happen together, then we will be in a position of getting that third human parallax cue, the focus parallax cues, to be correct.
Okay.
We're moving in that path, but I can't tell you that we're there yet.
Sure. So let's do, I'm going to pretend it's hypothetical. If you're going to project an image directly into your eyeball, as opposed to having your eyeball looking at a screen that's simulating what you're looking at, that is that the way to achieve that?
Well, yeah. I mean, the way to achieve it is to put the light, the right light field in front of people. It doesn't matter if you call it a projection or a reflection or none of that matters.
Okay.
If the light field is correct, then we're done.
Okay.
If the light field is not correct, then there will be inconsistencies in the cues that people experience with their visual system.
Okay.
They'll see a parallax, a binocular parallax that indicates a depth of something, and they'll see a focus blur that indicates a depth of something else, and they'll accommodate to us yet another place. All of these things will be inconsistent, and that disrupts the sense of immersion in the system.
Right.
And it actually, two of the cues to depth in people are special, accommodation and vergence, because they're actually physical cues. We actually physically change the focus of our eye. We actually physically rotate our eyes to point toward a fixation point. All the other cues are just aspects of the light field. But these two special cues are actually physical.
Right.
And the fact that they're physical means that they can result in discomfort if they don't work well together.
Right. Okay.
And this is where the, you know, why are people concerned about vergence accommodation conflict? Well, one of the reasons is that it's uncomfortable. Another reason is it's actually hard for some people to do it all. A fraction of the population just can't do the kind of decoupling of those things that's required to deal with these systems. So that fraction of the population is completely disenfranchised in current virtual reality and augmented reality systems.
Okay.
The rest of us are just hindered.
Okay.
Right. Some more than others. If you're a vision scientist and you've been practicing decoupling these things for the last 20 years of your life, you're pretty good at it by now.
Yeah.
But most people aren't vision scientists.
Right. Yeah, so you're basically asking your eyes to just stop doing the things you're doing.
What they do all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's insane. How the whole world works for us suddenly stops working.
Yeah.
And to be fair, people who create content for these systems know this. It's, you know, that's not a naivety about it.
Okay.
So you can create content that has a set of qualities about it that make it more or less tolerable for people.
Okay.
And so it's not like these problems aren't understood, and there are, as always, many ways to address them. But if you really want to solve it, then you've got to get the light field right.
Okay.
You know, bringing this back to our topic, right?
Yes.
If the light field coming into the eye is right, into the eyes, there's two of them.
Right.
Done.
Right.
And if it's not, then there's just always going to be struggle.
Okay. So this brings up this perfect segue for me, which is, I'm going to call it the problem with photorealism.
Yeah. Okay.
Photorealism is something that everyone has been like obsessed about for so long because they want it to look like a perfect photograph, but photographs are fundamentally flawed compared to our eyes. They have artifacts which we strive and call look that we strive for. We make photographs that have lens flares. We make we choose focus.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We do all kinds of things. This is not how our eyes work. And so if you're going to go into the virtual reality, which is should not look like a photograph. All of our graphic tools have been designed to look like photographs as opposed to look like what our eyes see. So how do you get people to let go of the concept of photorealism? What are some of the problems that you see with photorealism?
Yeah, a little bit this is a definitional problem.
Right.
So I have two. One of them, my whole graphics career hasn't been striving for photorealism because there's so many opportunities in graphics that are much far beyond realism.
Right, okay.
So, okay. So it's as a tool, realism is a constraint.
Right.
So, but I don't want to go there in this conversation.
Sure.
The other thing is, what we need to do is stop saying what we're striving for is photorealism and say instead what we're striving for is creating the correct light fields that stimulate people's eyes.
So we could call it ocular realism?
Yeah, we could call it light field realism. Okay. We could, you know, whatever. If you, this is where I was before. If we get the light fields right, we're done.
Okay.
Right? That's the right way to think about this. If you're in a world where you think that images are the right thing to present to people, then you're in yesterday's world.
Sure.
Right? We now understand, actually people have understood for a long time, but it's becoming more widely understood.
Right.
That the light field that you experience by looking at an image is an impoverished light field.
Right.
It all of the cues to depth that are focus cues indicate a depth of the image position.
Okay.
Right. If you move your head while you're looking at an image, nothing happens. Right. Yeah. Which means if you like, the other thing that happens is it looks like the world's swinging around behind the image plane.
Okay.
Right. So it's not just that it looks wrong, but it looks wrong in some pretty insidious ways.
Right.
And you can, like, if you look at the displays that work through cylindrical panoptics instead of spherical panoptics. I don't know if you've ever seen those 3D TVs. They give you parallax if you move your head left and right.
Yes.
But if you move up and down, they don't. Oh my gosh, that's so disorienting. When you move left to right, you have this vague, not very imperfect sense of a rigid world out there that you're getting a binocular stereo view of.
Yeah.
And then you move up and the whole world moves down, and you move down and the whole world moves up.
Right.
You know? So when you mix these cues up badly, it breaks really badly.
Right.
Hence, the right way to think of this is, no, we are not in the business in computer graphics of creating photorealistic images. Mm-hmm. We're in the business of creating realistic light fields.
Okay.
And the reason that people haven't fully gotten there yet is the world's capability of displaying realistic light fields is itself very immature.
Okay.
It's an old idea, integral imaging. You know, you can do it. You could do it a century ago.
Okay.
It just can't do it very well. And as we've agreed, the current set of head-mounted displays don't really try to do it at all.
Right.
And so it doesn't really matter how hard the rest of us try to send better information to those displays.
Okay.
Until the problem of stimulating correct accommodative response, you know, simulating focus depth is addressed by these displays, they're just broken in terms of creating the right light fields.
Right.
I have a lot of personal interest in that. I'm reviewing papers about it, okay. You know, right now. Right, I think the world will address these. Mm-hmm. That is not LITRO's axe to grind, right? We are working on the side of capturing the information that is the full light field,
okay,
and then recreating what you're describing, literally photorealistic
right.
images that are presented to the viewer's eyes.
Okay.
And with that constraint, we can get head motion parallax, we can get binocular parallax, we cannot get focus parallax correct.
Right.
We can chip away at it, but we'll never get it correct.
So your goal is not necessarily to fix the viewing experience. You're there to present the right information.
Well, let me put it differently. We're addressing a very important part. See, there's a difference between necessary and sufficient.
Okay.
In order to fix that viewing experience, it is necessary that there be content.
Yes.
It is also necessary that there be displays.
Right.
We are addressing the content side.
Okay.
And there are things that we can do directly to futz with the display side.
Okay.
But we're limited there. Now, my personal interest, I continue reviewing papers. I continue giving talks at conferences. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to move along the display side of things. Mm-hmm. But that's not LITRO's specific goal. That's my personal goal based on my background and interests.
Right.
But it is the combination of those that allows us to move from a world that was primarily about images to a world that is a system that is to do with light fields.
Okay.
When you capture as light fields, when you process, when you distribute, when you archive, when you everything, and then when you redisplay as light fields, when all of those pieces are in place, now we're in the place where we can do, I'm going to say, photorealistic light fields. Realistic light fields.
Yeah.
But until all those pieces are in place, we're doing a partial solution.
Right.
It doesn't mean it doesn't make a lot of sense to chip away at the parts. That's the only way we'll ever get it all right.
Right.
So LITRO is chipping away at a really huge part of it.
Yeah, I think it's important because I still think people are obsessed with the artifacts of of cameras, mm-hmm. the artifacts of cameras, including, you know, I worked on Tron Legacy mm-hmm. a long time
wow.
ago.
Yeah.
So, and it was great, you know, and this is a completely virtual world, whatever, and our cameras are there and all CG shots. But in order for it to look the way we wanted, we did things that were, that, you know, lots of lens flares. We would artificially put dirt on the lenses so they'd get these interesting artifacts
sure.
in there. I mean,
sure.
these are things that are not good, you know. You would imagine in a Tron world that the world would be unbelievably sharp and everything else. And not necessarily, mm-hmm. But we did this because it looked better. And we're used to seeing cameras or photographs that have artifacts in them. And that's what makes them seem real to us. But the VR world is not about cameras. It's about reality. And I think that's, I mean, I'm just reiterating what you're saying. If we do a light field, then it's, then my eyes can behave like eyes again, I guess.
That's right. But I think, I mean, this is a little outside of my area of expertise, but I'm going to wander just a bit and
okay.
say that there's, in vision science sometimes gets confused about this. There's really different, big difference between trying to get things right, realistic, and trying to entertain people, right? And the goal of entertainment isn't intrinsically to make things realistically right. The goal of entertainment is to entertain.
Sure.
And what you need to do to make all these cues right for, let's just say, a surgeon who's going to work remotely.
Yes.
Right. So that surgeon is used to seeing a particular thing in a particular way. I met a Stanford surgeon who did right. Inserted wires into people's cocleas.
Okay.
Right.
Yep.
And doing that, they actually learned how the light refracted around the liquid that picked up on the edge of the hull and
right.
how to, you know, guide the wire by looking at what they expected to see through that refraction. Like, if you're going to simulate that with graphics, you better make it right.
Yeah.
This is not about entertainment.
Yeah, yeah.
This
yeah.
is about providing exactly the right visual stimulation to an expert so that he or she can do their job.
Yes.
That same expert goes to the movies at night and has a very different set of criteria. The classic one for me is this thing about, do you want a 120 or 240 hertz smoothing in the replay of your television?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us who are used to watching cinema do not.
Right.
But as you say, if you look in a go to the United Visual Simulation Center mm-hmm. and sit in one of their simulators, you can better believe they're presenting that information at a very high frame rate.
Yeah.
And there's absolutely none of this 24 frame per second judder in it.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody minds, because what they're expecting to see in that experience is a good recreation of reality.
Yes.
My warning here is that I think pinholing virtual reality into only the reality side of that dichotomy is likely too limiting. People will want to watch TV in virtual reality. And all of a sudden, the quality of the light field that the virtual reality system mm-hmm. should be presenting to them, maybe it has the qualities of light fields that are cinematic rather than the qualities of light fields that are the kind of thing you'd do for a flight simulator.
Okay.
So it's probably more complicated than just a dichotomy. There's probably a whole range of these things.
Sure.
But I don't believe that virtual reality is only about reality any more than I believe that computer graphics should target itself only in the goal of accurately reproducing reality. There's so much more opportunity in this stuff than just reality.
Okay. That's a great way to say it. And so therefore, would you say that light field is very, very flexible and allows for things such as reality and other things as well?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's the complete description of all the light that's entering your eye.
And you
so
could display that
can
light
imagine,
in any way. Yeah.
Anything you can imagine can be represented. Anything you can visually imagine
right.
can be represented in a light field. There's nothing missing. Here I'm talking about the ideal mathematical light field. Of course, the engineering light fields always have some constraints. But in principle, mm-hmm. it's a complete stimulation of your visual system. So whatever.
So technically speaking, you could mimic different eye conditions. So if someone is severely myopic, you could mimic that. You can mimic, astigmatism or all these other effects
yeah.
through light field.
If you look at the virtual reality headsets that I'm not saying this incorrectly, the light field headsets that researchers at NVIDIA have done, that's one of the things they do.
Right.
You can take your glasses off and they'll just recalibrate the light field so that it produces a sharp retinal image when you're not being corrected by an intermediate lens.
That would be great because I'm very myopic. And
there's actually a lot of research in this so that people can look at the displays. When we get older, as I have successfully done,
yes,
our ability to accommodate, to change our focus distance goes gradually from huge as a child to zero.
Right.
Right. So I'm at Masa Manus zero at this point.
Right.
So when I'm
in the same boat.
When I swivel my eyes from looking out the windshield
right.
to looking at the instruments,
yeah.
I have to, the instruments that are a very different focus distance.
Right.
Right. That's bad. One of the solutions is this head-up display thing that puts the display sort of floating in space at a focus distance that's comfortable for me.
Right.
But another is to build an instrument panel in the car
right.
that creates a light field that has a focus distance that's well past itself. These are technologies that are being developed. I mean, they're not hypothetical.
No,
people
right. Now it makes sense why they did it. I never even thought about that. But yes, that makes sense. And that would be great for me.
This is one of the reasons why looking at your text, you know, why are traffic fatalities going up 7% a year now for the last 2 years after
right.
however many decades of going down? Is because people are looking at their little screens.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem is those little screens have a focus distance that's at their physical distance.
Right.
So if you swivel your view away from the world, you've actually got to recalibrate your vergence and your accommodation to look at this thing.
Right.
And that takes work and time. And then when you pop your view back up, it takes work and time to undo it.
Right.
And that's a commodity that drivers don't have.
Right. No.
So it's really dangerous. So I'm not advocating what should be done. I'm just pointing out that these issues of generating the wrong light field have safety implications. There's just all kinds of implications to doing this stuff badly.
Yeah.
And we're, as an overall technology, the world's beginning to get better
mm-hmm.
at doing these things well. And that will serve people.
Well, that is a very, very good description. I have a slightly technical question. You were talking about, you know, all the little mini cameras between each of the lenses, depending on what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
Or you'd have if the lens is very big or the area is very big, you would create individual cameras. Now, there's still a distance between each one of those cameras.
That's
so
right.
They're discrete. It's not
yes.
It's not infinite. How do you overcome that?
Well, it's the result of that technically is something called aliasing,
okay.
which you're probably familiar with
yes.
from rendering.
Of course.
Right. So it turns out that the sort of bad news about light fields, in principle, if you have full information reconstructing or a 2D image, like your virtual camera
mm-hmm.
is a very, very simple thing. If in some sense all the rays you could possibly want are available, you just choose the ones you want and you're done.
Right.
Unfortunately, as you've observed, all the rays you want aren't available for a whole bunch of reasons, including the fact that our samples are discrete locations or discrete locations with a little bit of focus integration across them.
Right.
And what this means in practice is that the reconstruction, the implementation of that virtual camera
mm-hmm.
is quite complicated.
Okay.
And with a little bit more detail, one of the things about it that it almost inevitably has to do is it has to, using whatever information it's got, make some assessment of how far the things are away that the light rays are, like where are the light rays coming from?
Right.
Right. It in order to do a good job of making that virtual camera work
mm-hmm.
when you don't have enough rays and they're not good enough rays,
mm-hmm.
you need to assess the an estimate of the depth, the distance that each of those
okay.
things comes
and
from.
And that helps achieve the anti-aliasing.
It achieves the anti-aliasing, achieves all kinds of
right.
things for us. But just as an engineering truism,
mm-hmm.
the more complicated and clever your algorithms are,
mm-hmm.
the more interesting the ways are that they fail.
Right? Okay.
So if you are building, I've built flight simulator visual
sure.
systems, and one of the goals there is to keep it as simple as possible
right.
because failure can't be tolerated, especially in military simulations.
Right.
It results in deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the military has very high standards. They're actually happy to take a sort of less good result at the peak
mm-hmm.
in order to have a reliably good result in certain respects, no
sure.
matter what. Right. So that's one way to think about how all this kind of stuff
mm-hmm.
works is that you got to be Well, you don't want to fail, but right. so as we make the reconstruction more and more clever, we get more and more interesting failures. Coming back to that cinematic camera, mm-hmm. like why is it as big as it is? Why does it have as many pixels as it has? The fundamental reason is that by collecting more data, we can be less clever right. with how we do those virtual cameras from
okay.
it. And the less clever we have to be, the more reliable it is. So remember you said people are fixated on what artifacts in images.
Yes.
I think in the Hollywood space, people are at least as fixated as anyone on mm-hmm. artifacts and imagery.
Right.
So if we build a system that does really, really well almost all the time, but fails pretty substantially every once in a while, mm-hmm. that's not an interesting system
okay.
for high-end cinematography.
Right.
Right. It needs to have a very high base.
Yes.
Right. And if it gets better than that a little bit, that's okay. But if it drops distinctly lower, that's a problem.
Okay.
And from an engineering standpoint, one way to achieve that mm-hmm. is to over-engineer the collection part mm-hmm. so that you can sort of reduce the amount of cleverness in the engineering.
Right.
You'll find that people who build airplanes think the same way, right? Failures are pretty intolerable.
So the more data you have, the less you have to think about the data.
The less clever the algorithms need to be
right.
to implement that virtual camera and okay. still get good results.
Right.
So for our virtual reality systems, we won't capture quite as much. Mm-hmm. We're prepared for a little bit more variation, right? That's a field that is nascent, mm-hmm. right? There isn't 30 years of history on what has to be true about virtual reality capture.
Right.
And we're solving some really important problems. So we give ourselves a little more room.
Okay.
But if you're going to make a product and sell it into high-end cinematography, mm-hmm. the standard's already remarkably high.
Yeah.
So you need to engineer with that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so that product is engineered, I would say, in a fundamentally different
yeah, that's way. Why it's why? That's as big it's as it is.
So big and has so many pixels and so high a frame rate. You know, choose almost any dimension of the sure. capture, and it's just really, really big.
Well, I did see, obviously, that there was, you know, you guys made a really great video about it and displaying how it works,
yeah.
and I was really impressed. And I started to get it a lot more. I think just understanding the potential of what that camera was, because the first thing that came to mind when I was sort of browsing the articles was the enormous amount of data.
Yeah.
And that is scary and almost like, well, how are you ever going to manage that amount of data? Mm-hmm. So that's a system, that's a problem that, you know, will eventually be solved, I think.
Well, the ability to manage data is going up exponentially.
Right. But then what was presented to me, and I actually think it was on a podcast. You may have been on a podcast. I think it was an FX Guide podcast. I don't remember who it was, but it was someone from Lytro talking about why the potential of what that camera could do and why mm-hmm. it's important. That's when it suddenly realized, like, oh, yes, it's not just about changing focus. It's about
it's definitely not just about changing focus.
No, and it started to really see the potential of it, and I was really, really impressed. I mean, it was a very important piece of information, and I think mm-hmm. it's really, really interesting. Yep. So, last thing about light field. Mm-hmm. Currently, we look at a certain range of frequencies of light.
Yes.
Are you guys looking at beyond frequencies, like infrared and ultraviolet? Or do you think that that's an important part of what light field has to offer?
Yeah, they're all light fields.
Right.
And there are problems to be solved in different wavelength ranges than human vision.
Mm-hmm.
As a practical matter, day to day, no, we're not.
Sure.
We've certainly had conversations over the years with people who have interesting problems and mm-hmm. would be interested. But one of the things a small company has to be pretty careful about is picking a few things and not too many things to work on. So,
okay.
So today, no, we're not working actively on out of human band light fields.
And I'll tell you why I jumped to that, because I skipped a couple of steps in my
sure.
thought
okay.
about that. One of the things I became fascinated with, a friend of mine builds amazing telescopes, right?
Yep.
And I saw huge apertures that he does in his mirror, yep. and I was like, wow, look at that. It's incredible. I could just imagine, like, when I was thinking about your cinema camera and the size of that, I could think, it was like, what if that was a telescope? What if it had the ability to look yeah. deep in space? Do you see any use cases where light field could be used for astrophotography?
Well, I guess I would say it even more directly. Astrophotography has been using light fields for a long time, and they're actually quite sophisticated.
Right, like the VLA is basically a light field, isn't it, in a sense?
Yeah, all light is a light field.
Right.
And one of the big challenges in that is if your camera is on Earth instead of up in the sky,
right,
then the light field is munged with,
right?
Right, because the atmosphere messes with it.
Okay.
And over the years, these people have become very sophisticated
right.
at modifying the light field in optomechanical ways, at least,
right,
so that they can recover from the aberrations that the atmosphere introduces.
Yes.
We could sit and talk about all the fancy things they've done.
I know, with the lasers and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. They're light fields, and they're doing clever things.
Right.
Shack Hartman sensors, you know, when you go to the optometrist and they measure your aberration and your focus and correction and all, they're just doing light field work. It's all the same.
Okay. Well, all right. I don't want to take up too much of your time. This has been a fantastic talk. I think a lot of people are going to be fascinated by it. I think it's going to really sort of enlighten people as to what light fields are and the future that they have to offer us. And so it's been really great. I really appreciate your time for this.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thank you.